Welcome. Thank you for being here. Great to see so many people willing to come out on a Friday night. I know there's a lot of things you could be doing tonight instead of coming and listening to a bunch of science-y kind of stuff. And hopefully it won't be too technical, but I try to really use PowerPoint to try to make the technical things a little bit more easy to understand. Last time I was here, I had to rush out of here. As some of you all may recall, I had my fourth child en route on that day and had to hustle back. And then the rest of the story you don't know about is that my wife didn't know I was coming back. And the first time she saw me was when I walked into the pregnancy room. And she had no idea that I'd even flown back yet. And she bust out in tears. And, you know, girls, you know, they're so... Come now and let us reason together. You know, the Bible's all about this idea of reasoning. It's not about this idea of just accepting something without evidence. Now, the atheistic community, naturalists, accuse religiously minded individuals of not using reason and logic and instead just using emotion and ultimately a lack of evidence. Reasoning together, that's hopefully what we're interested in doing, and that's what we want to do in this seminar. We want to use our heads, we want to look at the evidence and reason through to the truth and not just accept something without evidence, whether we're religious or irreligious. So there are many positive proofs for the existence of God and for the inspiration of the Bible, and a listing of those proofs is not the goal of this seminar. You can see materials to that end on our website at apologeticspress.org. But in this seminar, we want to look at the main response to the creation model that is given by the atheist. If you've been in the school system at all over the past 40 or 50 years, the natural response is, well, what about all this scientific evidence which supposedly proves naturalistic evolution and disproves the Bible? So atheists, people who don't believe in God, naturalists, evolutionary theory is their response to the question of creation and origins. And it's proven to be an effective message today. We've been told that evolution is the scientific choice, and people who don't believe it, people who believe, for example, in the Bible and creation, these people are unscientific. In fact, they're delusional and they're beholden to ancient myths and fairy tales. They're carriers of a blind, evidenceless faith. The well-known evolutionist and professor of zoology at Oxford University, Richard Dawkins, you probably heard of him, one of the most famous of evolutionists. It's absolutely safe to say that if you meet somebody who claims not to believe in evolution, that person is ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked, but I'd rather not consider that. And that attitude is typical among scientists in the evolutionary community. If you don't believe in evolutionary theory, if you believe in creation, then you're an ignoramus. You're an idiot, you're some kind of hillbilly from the South, right? Well, is he right? Is that true? Well, I'll grant him. He's certainly right about some people in the creationist community. I'll give him that. But not about all creationists. So that said, I think it's important to clarify here at the outset who I'm talking about when I talk about evolution being unscientific, creation not being unscientific, creation being more scientific. I want to make sure that I define what I'm saying clearly. Just because someone calls himself, for example, a creationist, it doesn't mean that he's using logic and reason and the evidence from science in order to arrive at a conclusion. In this seminar, when I say that creationists are scientific, I'm not talking about people who believe in God without any reasonable evidence, who claim that belief in God is like some leap into the dark, a leap of faith, as they call it, right? Accepting God without any proof, which is the idea that the denominational world in Hollywood seems to have about Christian faith, like this statement that was made in the 1947 movie, all the way back in 1947, Miracle on 34th Street, faith is believing when common sense tells you not to. I'm not talking about that kind of hocus pocus whenever I talk about creation being a scientific model. That sort of thinking gives religion, gives Christianity, gives creationism a bad name. So I want to make sure that I'm clear and distinguish truth from error on this. There are people on both sides of the fence, evolutionists and creationists, that are spreading false information about the beliefs of their side and the models of their side, probably unintentionally. But when people do that, doesn't it affect their credibility in the eyes of their listeners? So whenever I say that creationists are scientific, I'm talking about people who arrive at the truth from the facts. I'm talking about people who truly believe in John 8:32, that you can know the truth. You don't just have to blindly accept that just based on vague inner feelings or goosebumps or something. The biblical portrait of faith is not what many in Christendom seem to have of faith in the Bible, believing something without evidence and even against reason and common sense. Biblical faith in the Bible is more like the trust that you have for a parent or a friend. Do you blindly trust your parent? No, it's based on evidence. The person has proven themselves to be trustworthy. But many religious people, not just atheists, not just unbelievers, many religious people will just leave reason and thinking at the door whenever they enter into a building for worship. They leave their heads at the door and they proceed to rely on emotion, and they have a feel-good religion and they do whatever makes them feel good instead of what the Bible says. And so their evidence for God is typically vague, these goosebumps and skin tinglies, and they say they're from the Holy Spirit or something. And that's unfortunate because it's unbiblical and because it's hurting the case for God and creation. Many non-religious people rebel against that kind of behavior, and rightly so, right? They recognize that this touchy-feely approach to religion isn't based on evidence in using your head, using thinking and reason, but is rather based on feeling and therefore doesn't require any evidence. People who believe in things for which there is no evidence are being, by definition, irrational. In the field of philosophy, what's known as the law of rationality is used to determine whether a person is being irrational or illogical when coming to the conclusion about something. And we'll talk about this law, and I'll keep hammering it. If you remember nothing else from this weekend, you'll probably remember this law. It says that one should only draw those conclusions that are warranted by the evidence. Or as the Bible puts it in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, examine everything carefully, hold fast to that which is good. The Bible, authored by God, tells us that we can know the truth. It isn't to be accepted without evidence. It should be tested and proved, and God expects us to do that, and we can do that. The law of rationality, if it is violated, if someone draws a conclusion that doesn't follow from the evidence, then the perpetrator is known to be being irrational. I heard somebody say it, irrational. So, for example, if a person sees two green sedans drive by and they conclude, okay, well, all cars must be green from that, right? That conclusion would be considered irrational. There's not enough evidence to draw that conclusion. Right? God doesn't expect us to trust in Him without adequate evidence. He expects us to weigh the evidence available to us and come to the clear truth based on that evidence. To know the truth that will set us free, John 8:32, not just feel it without evidence. The Bible, which is the basis for the creation model, makes it clear that God has, in fact, left enough evidence to come to the truth about His existence and the origin of the universe. Acts 14:17. Nevertheless, He did not leave Himself without witness, and that He did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts with food and gladness. Romans 1:20, for since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. So not only can we come to the conclusion that God exists without even having a Bible, but you can even know something about the nature of this Creator without having a Bible. You can learn about the characteristics of this being, and in fact, the evidence is so decisive about it that you'll be without excuse if you don't come to this conclusion. In the end, you're not going to be able to say, you know, God, there just wasn't enough evidence. You're not going to be able to say that. You'll be without excuse, according to Romans 1:20. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork. So according to the creation model, there's evidence for creation. Now the naturalist, the atheist, argues, he bases his beliefs on things you can observe physically and argues that creationists, hey, you guys can't observe God, can you? Raise your hand if you can observe God directly. Okay, so that makes you guys all unscientific, right? You're unscientific now. Well, granted, you can't directly observe God. We can't taste, touch, hear, smell, see Him, right? We can't use empirical science to directly prove that God exists. But that doesn't follow that there isn't any physical evidence for His existence. Consider the work, for example, of forensic scientists. They come in after an event, a crime, for example, and they'll examine the evidence, and they're able to come to reasonable conclusions about what happened without actually having even witnessed what happened, using various kinds of reasoning, inferring from evidence. Much of science is based on that simple principle. Facts are discovered, inferences are made about what did happen, what will happen, what is happening, all without necessarily having physically witnessed whatever it is, and yet we consider it science. The nature of the evidence is indirect rather than direct. When we examine the evidence in the universe, the truth of God's existence, the error of naturalism is so clear that according to the Bible, again, it is without excuse. So the blind faith believer concept isn't true. Creationists who believe in those kind of things are in error, but evolutionists who believe in such things are in error as well. And in this seminar, that is the goal, to show that the whole evolutionary model is ultimately a blind faith. Naturalism is a blind faith. It has to be. The atheist has no choice but to have a blind faith. Now, before we dive in, consider for a moment, why is it even important to spend any time even discussing evolutionary theory? What's the big deal? You know, isn't this seminar really a big waste of time? Who cares if evolution is true? You know, maybe God just created the universe using evolutionary theory. You know, who cares? I mean, I can think of several people off the top of my head that have asked that question, and it's a valid question to ask. Why not theistic evolution? That's something that deserves an explanation. If you just read Genesis 1 and take it at face value, you're not going to get evolution out of that, right? That's why nobody did for hundreds of years, right? Darwin comes along, right? Someone has to have mentioned that possibility to you and made you feel pressured from some kind of alleged evidence to make a person try to see evolution in Genesis 1, right? You're not going to get it just from a straight reading of Genesis 1. Theistic evolutionists are people who've bought into some kind of evidence because of something they've heard, maybe from pressure or something, and it's caused them to reject the biblical description of creation in Genesis 1. But they obviously, if they want to continue to be a believer, they don't want to throw God and the Bible out, so they'll compromise their faith in the Bible, and that's what it is. It's a compromise. And they reject a straightforward reading of the Bible, and it's an attempt to harmonize evolution with creation, trying to squeeze it into the Bible. And so ultimately, you have to reinterpret the Bible in such a way that makes naturalism, sort of evolutionary theory, possible, usually reinterpreting Genesis chapter 1. Is there anything wrong with that? I mean, can a person accept evolution and the Bible simultaneously and still be consistent? The answer is no, and there's at least four reasons why. First, if evolutionary theory, then Genesis' account of creation is at best misleading and at worst inaccurate, which would categorize the Bible as uninspired right at the beginning. I mean, Genesis 1 is straightforward in its declaration that the universe was created in 6 literal days, and it gives no indication that it should be taken in any other way. In fact, Moses used practically every means at his disposal in the Hebrew language to convey the idea that the days of Genesis 1 were 24-hour days. Now, that's not something I want to get into this weekend. We have lots of material on our website which soundly proves that truth. If evolution is true, the Bible's wrong. If the Bible's true, evolution's wrong. There's no middle ground on this. Secondly, believing that the Genesis account is not literal and somehow allows for evolution puts Moses, Paul, and even Christ himself in the position of being mistaken or liars. Moses said in Exodus 20:11, "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day." What's left beyond the heavens, the earth, sea, and all this? Everything was created in 6 days. Use that word yamim there for the plural of days, which always indicates a literal day. There's no way around it. So was Moses wrong? Okay, you got to tear out a big chunk of your Bible, if that's right. In Romans 1, 18 through 32, Paul, clearly referring to humans, said that God's, again, we just looked at verse 20, God's attributes have been clearly seen when? Since the creation of the world. Okay, you can't make a statement like that if humans weren't around since the creation of the world and actually showed up at the very end billions of years later. Okay, so now you got to tear out all the books by Paul. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Right, so tear out what? Romans through what? Somewhere Hebrews, right? Potentially Hebrews. In Mark 10:6, Jesus said, God made man from the beginning, male and female. And again in Luke 11:50 through 51, he said that Abel lived at the foundation of the world. Now, according to the evolutionary timeline, humans showed up on the scene at the very end of the timeline, not at the beginning. So if evolution is true, then you've got a conundrum here. You've got Jesus, Paul, and Moses as all being either liars or mistaken, and ultimately our faith is hopeless. Thirdly, if theistic evolution is true, then the events of Genesis chapter 1 can't be literal. They can't mean what they seem. They have to be figurative or poetic or symbolic, non-literal, even though there's no indication that they are. Okay? Now, that's a problem because Genesis 1 is in a historical setting. It's in a literal setting. So if Genesis 1 in a historical setting without any indication that it should be taken as figurative or symbolic or poetic, no indication that it should be taken as anything other than history, if you now say, okay, well, that's not history, then why in the world can't you do that anywhere in the Bible? Yeah, there's definitely clear places where we've got figurative language being used. That's not Genesis 1. So, maybe the virgin birth didn't really happen. You know, maybe that's figurative, right? You know, baptism, you know, it's really a figurative thing. You don't really have to do that. I mean, you can do that anywhere. The minute you take a text that is clearly historical and say that it's not, why in the world wouldn't you do that elsewhere? That's exactly what people are doing, folks. That's what they're doing. I would argue a lot of it comes back to this very issue that's been shoved down our throat for so long. The natural flow of theistic evolution is that it leads you to compromise the Bible in many different places. Can prohibitions, against murder and adultery or divorce, can you really take that literally? Your whole faith just crumbles. The truth is Darwinian evolution and the Bible are incompatible. The gap theory, the day-age theory, all these theories that Bible's believers have come up with to try to harmonize what they're hearing out there in the secular world with the Bible, they don't cut it. Either the Bible's right or atheism is right, and there's no middle ground. So I'll be addressing atheistic evolution in these coming sessions. Number four, the primary reason we're looking at evolutionary theory in this study is because if there is no God, if atheists are correct, then there has to be an explanation as to how human beings, for example, arrived in the universe and how the universe itself could arise without his existence. Some form of evolution has to be true if that's the case. Evolutionary theory, the Big Bang, these are the atheist standard explanation today. If those are implausible, if they can be shown to be not in harmony with the evidence, then the atheist doesn't have an argument. Evolutionary theory crumbles. And if they're false, then what does that leave? What is that? If naturalism is not true, then some form of supernaturalism is true. It's definitely worthwhile to assess this idea of evolution and determine if it's valid. If evolution as defined by the naturalist today is true, then the Bible isn't, and vice versa. There's no middle ground. The creation must be ready to confront this issue, I believe, in order to be able to cast down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bring every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, 2 Corinthians 10:5. We have to be ready to give a defense of the truth on this issue today. Bottom line, if evolution is true, science is going to support it. It shouldn't contradict it at every turn, and vice versa. If creation is true, science is going to support it. Why would science lie? It's not like it has a mind. It doesn't have an agenda. It doesn't have a bias and prejudice one way or the other. Scientists may, and sadly, many do. It's hard to not have some kind of bias. But why would science lie? Many famous scientists today claim that the Bible and science are at odds with each other, that they can't both be true, that they're enemies. But science is not an enemy of the Bible. In fact, God himself instituted the field of science. Have you ever really thought about that? He commanded scientific exploration. Way back in the Garden of Eden, after he created Adam and Eve, what did he tell them to do? To subdue the earth and have dominion over it, Genesis 1:28. Isn't that essentially the goal of science? Psalm 111, verse 2, the works of the Lord are great, studied by all who have pleasure in them. Isn't that an encouragement of science? The study of nature to appreciate the great works of God. Romans 1:20, again, we can learn about the existence of God, even his attributes, again, by studying what? His creation. That's science. 1 Thessalonians 5:21, test all things, hold fast what is good. That's an eight-word summary of the scientific method right there. The true science and the Bible are not at odds, God himself having instituted the entire field of science. But still, evolutionists today claim that their theory is the scientific choice, and some are so bold as to claim that it's a proven fact scientifically. Have you heard that? It's fact. It's like Dawkins said, if you don't believe in it, you know, you're an ignoramus. Anyone who questions that gets expelled from the academic community. If you see this in the news recently about another guy that got booted because he questioned the fact that there was still tissue within dinosaur fossils. Yeah, that's something we'd predict. He questioned that. What happens to him? He got the boot. I mean, this is going on. Have you seen this movie Expelled, where Ben Stein documents this? Accusations against creationists tend to distract the world from the gaping holes in naturalism. That's my problem with it. In truth, the laws of science simply don't support the evolutionary model. They stand against it and in support of the creation model. When the evidence is weighed, with all preconceived notions dropped, I believe the answer is clear. The laws of science, the law of causality, first and second laws of thermodynamics, the law of biogenesis, genetics, and the laws of probability stand as impenetrable barriers in front of the theory of evolution. So we'll be looking at these six areas in this session and in the next one, as well as then looking at the alleged evidences for evolution to see if they do in fact support evolutionary theory. I think that what you'll find is science supports creation, and it's the evolutionary model that contradicts it. Now, before I can prove that, let's define what I mean by the evolutionary model. What do evolution and creation models ultimately claim? Now, first of all, keep in mind when I use the term evolution, I try to emphasize this because any critics that show up and come and chew on me after my seminars, I want to make sure they get what I'm saying when I define evolution. I'm using it in the way that naturalists use it, the theory of how the universe got here, not just life. Some simply lump the entire history together, the history of the world together, the history of the universe together, into this word evolution. Some will use this term cosmic evolution. So I'll use the term evolution to mean Darwinian evolution, so the general theory of evolution, in conjunction with like the Big Bang theory, which is the standard cosmological model today. I'll also use the term macroevolution interchangeably with that to describe this form of evolution. Now, I distinguish that from microevolution, right? Microevolution is small changes within kinds, so like changes in size and color and so forth, beak size. With the present kind remaining the same, microevolution has been observed to occur in nature. We don't have a problem with that. It's in harmony with the creation model. Macroevolution requires a jump across a phylogenetic boundary, an interkind evolution that is a leap beyond the evidence to accept that. So when I say in the seminar evolution is scientific, or evolution is unscientific, I'm talking about cosmic evolution, the naturalists, the atheist explanation for the origin of life, the origin of man, the universe at large. Now, this chart is going to be this origin model comparison. Now, there's essentially seven fundamental planks that have to be true if naturalism is going to be true. And the first one is the universe had to have come from somewhere. It had to pop into existence, or it had to have existed forever. Of course, the creation model says, no, it was created suddenly by something outside the universe, a non-physical entity. If evolution is true, life had to spontaneously generate. So non-life had to give rise to life. Of course, the creation model says it was created, again, by this outside force. Macroevolution is true and accounts for the existence of different kinds of animals if evolution is true. So ultimately, all present kinds came about from simpler, earlier kinds. Ultimately, single-celled organisms evolved into invertebrates, then amphibians and reptiles and mammals, and ultimately primates, including man. Whereas the creation model would say that all present kinds, including all plants and animals, have remained fixed since creation. I'm not using the term species, I'm saying kind. That's the biblical term. That's different. The idea of species was not around whenever kind was used to define used back in Genesis chapter 1, and also with regard to the kinds that were on the ark. Okay, so there may have been extinctions and genetic variation in these originally created kinds occurred within narrow limits, but new species and subspecies within created kinds can occur, but again, those amount to small changes like color and beak size and so forth. In other words, microevolution, but change between kinds, or vertical evolution, macroevolution, isn't true according to the creation model. Number four, neo-Darwinism is the mechanism for the evolution of complex kinds from a simple primordial organism, and this is the popular version of Darwinism today. Well, of course, the creation model would say that's insufficient to account for the emergence of present-day kinds from a simple primordial organism. Humans and apes have a common ancestor according to the evolutionary model. We, of course, say we have a separate ancestry. According to the evolutionary model, uniformitarianism is true when looking at the geologic strata, for example, and dating techniques, whereas we would say catastrophism is true. The earth and life are very old, have to be, in order for evolution to occur, and which is based on this uniformitarianism idea. And according to the creation model, they're actually relatively young, on the order of thousands of years. Now, any one of these statements, if they can shown to be wrong, then the entire model collapses, because these constitute fundamental planks of these two origin models. So throughout the following sessions, I want to go through each of the seven planks on the left here systematically to see if they can, in fact, be harmonized with the evidence. The goal of this seminar is to systematically address the entire naturalistic model in depth and to show that science doesn't support these fundamental planks, but instead actually supports the creation model the whole time. So we'll come back to this chart several times in the following sessions. In this first session, we're going to take a look briefly at three of the laws of science to see what they have to say about the matter of origins. The laws of science have been discovered through extensive scientific investigation, gathering mounds and mounds of evidence that all has shown to point to some conclusion. They are by definition a concluding statement that has been formed to explain how things work in nature at all times without exception. According to the McGraw-Hill Dictionary of Scientific and Technical Terms, a scientific law is a regularity which applies to all members of a broad class of phenomena. Keep in mind three things about scientific laws. Number one, scientific laws apply to all members of a broad class of phenomena, not just some. There are no exceptions to a law of science. Number two, scientific laws describe what has been observed to occur in nature. They say nothing directly about supernature. Number three, a scientific law is by definition rational. It is the conclusion that has been drawn from the scientific evidence. Keep in mind, the law of rationality says one should only draw those conclusions that can be drawn from the evidence. Since the laws of science are the conclusions from the evidence, then if you hold to a belief that is against the laws of science, you are by definition being
unscientific.
Irrational, unscientific. Yeah. Famous atheist, theoretical physicist, and cosmologist of Cambridge University, another very famous guy, Stephen Hawking, recently hosted a show on Discovery Channel. It's actually been, I guess, probably 3 years now, where he slammed theism and promoted atheism. And in that show, he said, the universe is a machine governed by principles or laws, laws that can be understood by the human mind. But what's really important is that these physical laws, as well as being unchangeable, are universal. They apply not just to the flight of the ball, but to the motion of a planet and everything else in the universe. Unlike laws made by humans, the laws of nature cannot ever be broken. That's why they're so powerful. The laws of nature are fixed. Evolutionists claim to believe firmly in the laws of science. We're going to examine that and see if that's just words. Does the naturalist actually believe in that idea? Is naturalistic evolution really in harmony with the scientific evidence? The first big question, which is yet unanswered by the evolutionist, the naturalist, that illustrates the fact that evolution requires a blind faith. Why do the laws of science even exist? Where did they come from? Who wrote them? Without a lawmaker, how could they even exist? Humanist Martin Gardner wrote a few years ago, imagine that physicists finally discover all the basic waves and their particles and all the basic laws and unite everything in one equation. We can then ask, why that equation? And why are there quantum laws? There is no escape from the super ultimate questions. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why is there something structured the way that it is? Even if you ignore the little problem of how the universe came into existence in the first place, you still have the problem of where these laws that govern that matter, where did they come from? How did they come into being? Why are there specific equations and specific numbers that describe how things work? Equations, by definition, that's not random. That indicates structure and design and intent and planning. That's a mind. That indicates a mind. Those kind of words can't be used to describe random chance processes and chaos, which are words that describe evolution. Bottom line, someone had to write the laws for the universe to follow. The atheistic evolutionary community admits they don't have an answer to that. And they admit it and they move along like, yeah, that's no big deal. We can just ignore it. That's no big deal. Whatever. Now, wait a minute. If there's not a reasonable answer to that question, atheism is false before you even get started. Stephen Hawking believes that quantum mechanics could create a universe from nothing before this supposed Big Bang happened, which he also believes in. But again, even if that were true and the evidence stands against it, Hawking himself still had to ask the questions, did God create the quantum laws that allowed the Big Bang to occur? In a nutshell, did we need a God to set it all up so that the Big Bang could bang? Now, his stubborn answer was no. But the problem is, he couldn't provide an answer to those questions. He couldn't even attempt an explanation, and yet he still flat out rejects the idea of a God whose existence would actually give him a reasonable answer to that problem. Does a law ever write itself? You ever seen that happen? What does the evidence say? If there's a law, there is a law writer. That's the evidence. You want to be rational? You got the answer. Draw conclusions warranted by the evidence. The evidence says laws are always the product of a mind. Therefore, there must be a mind. It's not hard. Stephen Hawking doesn't have an answer to that question. How could a law of nature exist without a law writer? How about another famous atheist, a theoretical physicist, cosmologist, astrobiologist of Arizona State University, Paul Davies, another famous atheistic type. He said, you need to know where those laws come from. That's where the mystery lies, the laws. Big mystery. They don't have an answer, but don't worry about it. Who cares? We'll just move on. Because naturalism is true. Those guys are ignoramus hillbillies over there. You don't even have an answer to the question. We've got an answer, and it's rational. You don't have an answer, and yet you're a naturalist. The existence of the laws of science are proof that God exists and that naturalistic evolution is inadequate in its attempt to harmonize with the evidence. One of the things I'm going to try to point out to you over and over, while the naturalistic model has no reasonable explanation for several critical points in the universe, guess what? The creation model is perfectly in harmony with them. Little by little, as the scientific evidence is examined, we discover more about the natural world, barriers are being raised up in front of the evolutionary model that prohibit it from being true, and so they have to keep trying to get around the walls. Right? Guess what is standing unscathed? What model? While the atheistic models can't explain the origin of the laws of science, the creation model has a rational explanation. Long before the laws of thermodynamics were formally articulated in the 1850s, long before the law of biogenesis was formally proven by Pasteur in 1864, the laws of science were written. Remember in the last few chapters of Job, God made a speech to Job, humbling him with the knowledge that Job essentially knew nothing in comparison to God, who knows everything and created everything in the universe. You remember two of the humbling questions that God asked Job? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set their dominion over the earth? Those are rhetorical questions. The obvious answer is no, sir. I don't know. No, sir. I couldn't write the laws. I don't even understand them. Implied in the questions is the fact that laws of science were written by God. So, of course, you would expect them to be in harmony with which model? The creation model. In the same way that a poem requires a poet, a law requires a law writer. Atheism can't give an explanation for their existence, which leaves a supernatural explanation which is in harmony with the creation model. Let's consider the laws of thermodynamics to see what they have to say about evolution. I want to systematically look through the implications of these two laws to make this point clear, because the scientific implications of these two laws alone give strong evidence for the existence of God and by implication the failure of naturalism, naturalistic evolution. The principles of thermodynamics have been in existence since the creation of the universe, one engineering textbook says. The word thermodynamics stems from two Greek words, therme, meaning heat. You'll recognize words like thermometer, thermostat, thermos. The second word, dunamis, meaning power. So it describes the early efforts by engineers to convert heat into power or energy. Today, thermodynamics is more broad. It deals with the science that deals with all aspects of energy and energy transformation. What in the world does that have to do with evolution and the origins question? Well, stand back here and consider for a moment. Where could the universe have originally come from? What are the possibilities? Let's think through that question without assuming anything. Let's don't assume God. Let's just look at the evidence and reason through what are the possibilities. Let's make it a little more tangible. Let's say you come across a sealed box in your garage. It's closed up and it's sealed and you shake it and you realize there's a ball in there. How'd that ball get in there? What are all the possibilities, even the crazy ones? Well, either someone put it here, right? So somebody opened that box and put it in there, or they built the box around it, or no one put it there. So it created itself or always existed inside of there. That's what you got. And the same options are available for the origin of the universe. How did it get here? Well, the creationist answer, of course, is in the very first verse of the Bible. Genesis 1 and verse 1. In the beginning, God opened the box and put the ball in. Okay? That's the creationist answer to this. We're given the creation model's answer to the question right at the beginning. Now, how would we describe that from a more scientific perspective? Now, from a thermodynamic perspective, we could describe the creation model this way. Imagine that box from your garage. Imagine it's big enough to fit the whole universe in it. Everything physical is in there. So the box is the exterior boundary of the whole universe. Everything in the universe is in that box, and it represents a closed system. If we're using thermodynamic terminology, that just means nothing's going into the box because everything in the universe is already in there, and nothing's going out of the box because the boundary is encompassing this entire universe at all times. Now, according to the creation model, before day one, the box was empty. God essentially opened the box, created the universe, put it in the box, and then closed it and sealed it so that nothing else could enter or leave it. So the box has remained closed since then, except at those times when God engaged in some kind of miraculous activity. So activity that momentarily puts the laws of physics on hold and allows him to do something that's not natural, above nature or supernatural. So that's the creation model in a nutshell. Now, the evolutionary model typically includes some form of the Big Bang theory. So steady-state Big Bang theory claims that all of the matter and energy of the universe was originally crammed into this extremely hot, dense sphere the size of a period on a piece of paper, the cosmic egg, or as they call it, the ilum. And then this tiny sphere supposedly exploded, hence the Big Bang, and then expansion occurred over time until we have the universe as it is today. Now, the problem is that even if you believe in the Big Bang theory, it still doesn't explain, right? You know where I'm going with this. It doesn't explain where that little sphere could have come from, right? That little ball that blew up. Where did it come from? Even if we were to grant that the Big Bang actually happened, which we don't, but for the argument, sake of argument, let's grant it. Where did the ball come from? The Big Bang Theory doesn't give an answer to that question. It doesn't tell us how the ball got into the box in your garage. Evolutionist Alan Guff is a cosmologist and physics professor at MIT, and he admitted this very point, recognizing that the Big Bang attempts to explain why the universe appears to be expanding or inflating, but it still doesn't explain where that little universe ball originally came from. He said inflation itself takes a very small universe and produces from it a very big universe, but inflation by itself doesn't explain where that very small universe came from. That's an important question. Later, he said, a proposal that the universe was created from empty space is no more fundamental than a proposal that the universe was spawned by a piece of rubber. It might be true, but one would still want to ask where the piece of rubber came from. Now, logically speaking, you got three options for where it could have come from. The well-known philosopher and evolutionist from the 1800s, Herbert Spencer, he said, respecting the origin of the universe, three verbally intelligible suppositions may be made. We may assert that it is self-existent, so eternal, it's always existed, or that it is self-created, so it popped into existence and created itself, or that it is created by an external agency. And that's true. That's what reason and logic tell us. Those are the three options. So which option is right? Which one is in harmony with the evidence? Creation, spontaneous generation, or eternality? In the famous words of Sherlock Holmes in 1890, when you've eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. So if two of these possibilities for the origin of the universe can be shown to be not in harmony with the evidence scientifically, that is, they violate the laws of science, then the other alternative must be the case. Now, if you choose the atheistic route, if you're going to be a naturalist, you've obviously eliminated already one option from the table, and you're left with two. In order to attempt to be rational, you have to believe in one of these possibilities since you don't believe in God. Either it's self-created, spontaneous generation, or it's self-existent, it's eternal. Now, if you believe in the spontaneous generation option, that is, that matter just spontaneously generated, just popped into existence on its own from nothing, then in a thermodynamic sense, you believe that that original box in the garage was initially completely empty. Let's zoom inside of the box. Okay, so the box is empty. The spontaneous generation model claims no one put matter in the universe. It put itself here. So according to the model, you can stand around inside of that box and just stare into nothingness. And as long as you have enough time, all of a sudden, something could just appear. And not only could something pop into existence, but according to this version of the model, a little ball containing all of the mass and energy of the entire universe could just pop into existence. And then, so they say, the Big Bang process will start, and eventually, you know, you give it enough time, universe expands, life pops into existence and gradually evolves over time, and ultimately you accidentally show up in the universe. There's some problems with that idea. Evolutionist Willard Young explained the first law of thermodynamics this way, and correctly, when he said, describing it, energy can be neither created nor destroyed, but can only be converted from one form to another. He's right, no argument there. That's what the first law says. In nature, energy can be neither created nor destroyed, can only be converted from one form to another. Also, this law is known as the law of conservation of matter or energy. Now, what does that mean, practically speaking? First law says that in a process like wood burning, matter and energy will change in other forms while it's burning. So heat and light and smoke and ash, right? But the amount of energy in the universe that was present before you burned it is the same as is present after you burned it. Energy hasn't disappeared or been destroyed from the universe by burning the wood, and energy hasn't popped into existence. Now, using more technical terminology, it says that in a closed system like our box that contains the whole universe, there's no energy coming into the system or leaving it. No one's opening the box and putting energy or matter into the box or taking it out. Then the amount of energy within the boundaries of that system will remain constant. So as this chart shows, the amount of energy before a process like wood burning or the universe popping into existence, the amount of energy present before a process has to equal the amount of energy after the process. That's the first law of thermodynamics. If you start with no energy, no matter in the box before a process, then in order to equalize it, you'll end up with no matter after the process. You seeing the implications here? Not that complicated. If you start with no matter in the universe before the appearance of the cosmic egg, no energy is going to be able to create itself to bring forth the cosmic egg. Nothing pops into existence. In other words, it doesn't matter how long you stare into empty space. A pew isn't going to just pop into existence, and it's not going to start coming to life and walking around. It doesn't matter how long you wait for that to happen. That's just not going to happen. Nothing's going to pop into existence. Not a little molecule, definitely not trees or fish or apes, not humans, even if they act like apes. And definitely not a small sphere containing all of the energy of the entire universe. It's not going to happen according to the first law of thermodynamics, which, remember, doesn't have exceptions. There's never been an exception to the law witnessed. So by implication, it would be unscientific. It would go against the laws of science to believe that matter could have come into being in such a way that that law was violated. According to the first law, the only way matter can appear in that box is if it was caused to appear there by some outside being. That's what we learn from the scientific evidence. Evolutionists who believe in spontaneous generation admit there's no evidence for it. Atheist Victor Stanger is an evolutionary particle physicist and professor at the University of Colorado. He believes in this idea of spontaneous generation, but he actually came out and said, "I must admit that there are no empirical or observational tests that can be used to test the idea of an accidental origin." What? Now, part of the naturalist definition of science includes the ability to observe and test a theory. You mean spontaneous generation of matter is a genuine blind faith? True Christianity is built on faith, but as I said, it's not blind. There's abundance of evidence to support it. The trust that we have in the Christian system is based on evidence. It's not a blind leap into the dark. But according to atheists themselves, there's no evidence to support the spontaneous generation of matter. Now consider, if there's no scientific evidence for it, how can it be considered to be scientific? Even by their own definition, there's no way to test it. It's a leap into the dark without evidence. No wonder many evolutionists reject this idea of spontaneous generation as an option for the origin of the universe. Recall famous evolutionary astronomer Robert Jastrow. He said, "But the creation of matter out of nothing would violate a cherished concept in science, the principle of conservation of matter and energy," as the first law of thermodynamics, which states that matter and energy can be neither created nor destroyed. Matter can be converted into energy and vice versa, but the total amount of all matter and energy in the universe must remain unchanged forever. It's difficult to accept a theory that violates such a firmly established scientific fact. I think that's pretty straightforward. But wait, what about quantum mechanics? Doesn't quantum theory indicate that something can come from nothing? This is a recent argument being made by some in the naturalistic community. But quantum fluctuations, this is going to get a little technical, quantum fluctuations that convert energy to matter must first start with a quantum field. So you're still not starting with nothing. Stephen Hawking attempts to argue that the universe could pop into existence since he believes that there's a zero energy balance in the universe. And there is now, and he said there was zero energy before the cosmic egg appeared. But even if he could prove that there really is a zero energy balance in the entire universe, which he can't, He still admits that there was no energy in the universe before, and now there is energy, regardless of whether or not it balances out to zero due to its positive and negative signs. According to the first law of thermodynamics, that energy has to be accounted for. It can be neither created nor destroyed in a natural process. Strictly according to the scientific evidence, the laws of science, specifically the first law of thermodynamics, the spontaneous generation of matter could not have happened. Now keep in mind, scientific laws do not have exceptions or else they would not be laws. By definition, scientific laws describe regularities that apply to all scenarios that the law applies to. In order for something to be a law, scientists could never have observed any exception to the rule. A prominent thermodynamics textbook that's used in engineering course curricula says the basis of every law of nature is experimental evidence, and this is true also of the first law of thermodynamics. Many different experiments have been conducted on the first law, and every one thus far has verified it, either directly or indirectly. The first law has never been disproved. We can say that the second law of thermodynamics, like every other law of nature, rest on experimental evidence. Every relevant experiment that has been conducted, either directly or indirectly, verifies the second law, and no experiment has ever been conducted that contradicts the second law. The basis of the second law is therefore experimental evidence. The evidence from science is that the laws of thermodynamics are immutable, they are unbreakable, so we call them laws. And when the first law indicates that the universe can't pop into existence from nothing, it means it. That's what that means. But notice the creation model doesn't contradict the first law of thermodynamics. The first law says that in nature, nothing, mass, matter, energy, nothing's going to pop into existence from nothing. It won't create itself. Believing in an idea like that is like believing in witchcraft without a witch. The only way energy can come into being in a system that didn't originally already have that energy is if it was deposited there by something outside of the box. In other words, the universe box, which contains everything from the natural universe, would have to be opened up and energy have to be put in by something super nature, something outside of the or above the natural universe, which is exactly what the creation model says happened. Genesis 1 tells us God put everything in the universe box. And then Genesis 2, 1 through 2 says, thus the heavens and the earth and all the host of them were finished. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had done. So in keeping with the first law, matter didn't create itself. It was put here by a supernatural agent, Jehovah. And after he created it, he shut the universe box. In other words, he rested or ended his work. Nothing else is being put into the box. Nothing else is coming into existence. Nothing's creating itself. That's a summary of the first law of thermodynamics. Isn't it amazing? It's amazing to me that scientists really didn't formally state this stuff and figure out, scientific equations and so forth until like the 1800s. And yet God already laid out the thrust of this thousands of years ago. The creation model is in perfect harmony with science, with the first law of thermodynamics, unlike the evolutionary model. What about this other option? Could matter be eternal? Could it have existed forever? The eternality model claims that the universe has always been inside of this box. So no one put it here. It didn't pop into existence. Instead, the universe has always been. It's either been moving through space forever, expanding, or if you believe in the oscillating universe model, you'd believe the universe operates in a cycle involving collapse, another big bang, expansion, collapse, another big bang, expansion, and so forth, repeating forever. Either way, this model says that matter and energy are eternal. It's always been here. But again, you've got another major problem in light of the actual scientific evidence. And the problem comes in the form of the second law of thermodynamics. Recall this well-known atheist and physicist, Paul Davies. Writing in New Scientist, he said, the celebrated second law of thermodynamics says, roughly speaking, that in any change, the universe becomes a slightly more disorderly place. The entropy goes up, the information content goes down. This natural tendency towards disintegration and chaos is evident all around us. And he's right, no problems there. Returning to this wood-burning example, when wood burns, all of the energy that was present before it burned is still present according to the first law. But according to the second law, much of it is transformed into less usable forms of energy, like heat. And after that heat dissipates, you're essentially left with a pile of ash, which of course isn't nearly as usable. In a technical sense, the second law builds on the first. Even though you got the same amount of energy present after process before it, according to the first law, some of that energy is transformed into less usable energy. This is known as entropy, and it's irreversible. And what that means, practically speaking, is that everything is wearing out. It's decaying. And we can slow the process, but we can't stop it. The universe is running down or running out of usable energy. Nothing lasts forever. And you can see that idea everywhere, can't you? The car doesn't get nicer over time. It's going to deteriorate. It's going to rust. It's going to fall apart. Your room doesn't get cleaner on its own without someone working on it. And that probably would look more like my room than the kids' room, probably. That's very unfortunate. The second law prohibits this from happening. A house is paint job. Not really. My wife keeps our room spick and span. I'm just saying that. A house's paint job is not going to get nicer over time. Of course not. It's going to fade. It's going to chip. The house is going to wear out and eventually collapse. Now, just like with the first law, the second law has never been broken. It has no exceptions. A prominent engineering thermal science textbook says, to date, no experiment has been conducted that contradicts the second law, and this should be taken as sufficient proof of its validity. Boy, I wish they would actually listen to the courses of the courses these guys take. It should be taken as sufficient proof of its validity. So, what does this mean concerning the origins question? What are the implications? Well, it means the universe couldn't have always existed and we still have usable energy. According to the second law of thermodynamics, if the universe is infinitely old, we shouldn't have any usable energy left. Everything should be completely worn out. You can't reverse entropy. And yet, we have an abundant amount of usable energy in the universe in harmony with, the creation model, which says the universe is actually relatively young, on the order of thousands of years. The scientific evidence doesn't lead to the conclusion that matter can be eternal, and therefore some scientists have come out in agreement. Recall the famous evolutionary astronomer Robert Jastrow of NASA, considered to be one of the greatest science writers of our age. He said, and concurrently there was a great deal of discussion about the fact that the second law of thermodynamics applied to the cosmos indicates the universe is running down like a clock. If it's running down, there must have been a time when it was fully wound up. Modern science denies an eternal existence of the universe. Now, three lines of evidence, the motions of the galaxies, the laws of thermodynamics, the life story of the stars, pointed to one conclusion, all indicated that the universe had a beginning. Kitty Ferguson is an award-winning science writer and evolutionist. She agreed. She said, it's also common knowledge that the universe isn't eternal, but had a beginning. So many in the evolutionary circles are realizing that the universe could not have existed forever. But the skeptic says, couldn't there have been an exception to the laws of thermodynamics at some point in the past? Well, again, according to the definition of a scientific law, there are no exceptions to laws. The laws of thermodynamics don't have exceptions. They are the fixed, unvarying conclusions from the scientific evidence. To claim that there are some unknown exceptions would be to claim something that goes against the actual evidence. In other words, it would be irrational. All right, we're getting this. The laws of thermodynamics are firmly established and beyond doubt. A perpetual motion machine, you heard one of these? This is a design that tries to violate either the first or the second laws of thermodynamics. A machine that tries to find an exception. That's the point of the machine. Numerous attempts have been made over the years to try to design such a machine, all without success. If you could do that, you'd be rich. But these are simply impossible. Even the government of the United States understands that, whether or not they fully grasp the implications. The laws of thermodynamics have been substantiated to the point that in 1918, the U.S. Patent Office declared that they would no longer even accept patent applications for alleged perpetual motion machines. The Patent Office is sick of getting applications for these impossible devices. They recognize the attempts as pointless. But as Philip Yam, writing in Scientific American, said, claims for perpetual motion machines and other free energy devices still persist, of course, even though they inevitably turn out to violate at least one law of thermodynamics. There's simply no exceptions to laws of thermodynamics. Now, to develop a theory that requires breaking the laws of thermodynamics would be unscientific. Developing a theory that sets the universe up as a perpetual motion machine, being able to last forever and defying the second law of thermodynamics, that's unscientific. It doesn't matter how much jargon a person tries to use to confuse the issue and throw dirt into the air for the layman person. Believing in ideas like that is irrationally drawing conclusions not warranted by the actual scientific evidence. Evidence, all of which supports the idea that nothing lasts forever. But guess what? Biblical creation model, perfectly in harmony with the second law of thermodynamics, creation model even predicts decay and a gradual loss of usable energy, doesn't it? Just as the second law states. According to the creation model, the universe is not going to last forever, and it's going to grow old. It's going to deteriorate. Hebrews 1, quoting from Psalm 102, "You, Lord, in the beginning laid the foundation of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain, and they will all grow old like a garment. Like a cloak you'll fold them up, and they'll be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not fail." Second law of thermodynamics is right there in the Bible. What does the evidence indicate? There are only three options for the origin of the universe. You got creation, you got it popped into existence, or you got it existed forever. Number two, we know by definition the laws of science don't have exceptions. Number three, the laws of science prohibit the only possible evolutionary models. And number four, the creation models in perfect harmony with these laws of science and even predicts their effects. By conclusion then, the creation model is the scientific choice. There's our word again. It's the rational choice. And guess what? It's the only possible choice once you actually examine the evidence and eliminate the naturalistic option. And guess what? There's something else you can draw from that. We can infer something without ever having actually witnessed him. Right? There's got to be some God out there. There's got to be something outside the universal box that did this. The scientific evidence points to the fact that there is a God. The third law of science I want to look at pretty briefly. It stands against this atheistic evolutionary models like the Big Bang. The law of cause and effect, or the law of causality. It basically says if there's an effect, there must logically be a cause. More precisely, it says that every material effect must have an adequate antecedent or simultaneous cause. The cause has to precede or come before the effect, or occur at the same time as the effect, and it has to have the necessary potential or the necessary power to cause whatever the effect is. And that's so obvious that scientists take it for granted. It's just assumed. But in actuality, scientifically speaking, this isn't some idea that you can just brush aside and not consider in this debate. The goal of scientific experimentation is to figure out what will happen, what will be the effect, if you do certain things, if you initiate certain causes. If there is no relationship between cause and effect, then there is no such thing as science. Nothing could be taken for granted. You know, one day gravity may be in effect, and the next day it's not. You just start floating up into the air. You just never know, you know. There would be no such thing as a scientific law because there'd be no such thing as a regularity, which is a part of the definition of a law. The National Academy of Sciences guidebook for teaching about evolution and the nature of science. It says one goal of science is to understand nature. Understanding in science means relating one natural phenomenon to another and recognizing the causes and effects of phenomena. Causality, law of cause and effect, fundamental to the field of science. If a baseball comes flying over the fence in your backyard, you know someone caused that, right? It didn't start flying on its own. The baseball is the effect of some cause. If you lean against a mountain, you're not going to cause it to topple over. It doesn't matter how hard you push. An adequate cause has to be present to create such an effect. If you're sitting in a room and a wind-up toy comes running across the floor in front of you, you know someone wound that toy up and sent it running, right? This is science. If you open up the cookie jar and you see a half-eaten cookie and there are children in your house, you know what happened. The cookie did not eat itself. It's possible I'm in your house too. If a chair is not placed in an empty room, then the room will remain
empty.
Yeah. Chairless, empty, good. Yeah, I get different answers to that question, believe it or not. Understand, though, this principle, you know, it seems common sense and simple. It's easy to not fully grasp how important this is in the creation-evolution debate. The law of causality is a major problem if you're a naturalist. There has to be a cause for the universe and for life, and atheists don't have one. The pyramids of Giza, one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. The world can't come to an agreement as to how these great structures were built and exactly why. You know, remember there's this movie Stargate, where they say aliens came and built it and stuff. You know, scientists, they may not know with certainty how or why they were built, but guess what they do know? They didn't happen on their own. Intelligent design was involved, some cause. We understand this. Stonehenge in Great Britain. After studying these interesting rock formations, scientists concluded they were likely designed to allow predictions based on the stars above. But guess what? We still got a lot of questions that remain unsolved. How was that information used? How were the rocks transported to that location and set up exactly? Well, we don't know. But one thing is clear. Even though they weren't there to witness the creation of those formations, scientists recognized the presence of intelligent design. An adequate cause was necessary to build those formations. Who's going to be senseless enough to try to argue that they happened on their own? Could someone try to say that? Yeah, and they'd look just as silly as the naturalists do. Amazing that they've gained so much traction. The Bible says that's going to happen, though, and we know why. We'll talk about that in our last session. Common sense tells us there must have been an adequate cause for these formations. Unfortunately, common sense doesn't seem to have a place in a discussion on origins and the science in the science realm today, we know in nature an effect has a cause. The fact that planets exist and they're floating through space and they're spinning, that's an effect. The existence of life, living beings, that's an effect. There had to be an adequate cause for that. Someone had to cause those things to happen, but the naturalist doesn't have an explanation for that. Now, that said, evolutionists are in a fix. They're trying to explain how the effect of this infinitely complex universe could have come about without a cause. Some 3 decades ago, Robert Jastrow, who I quoted earlier, NASA, he said, "The universe and everything that has happened in it since the beginning of time are a grand effect without a known cause." An effect without a cause, that's not the world of science. It's a world of witchcraft, of wild events and the whims of demons, a medieval world that science has tried to banish. As scientists, what are we to make of this picture? I do not know. Now, understand, when Jastrow admits that there's no known cause for everything in the universe, he's talking about the fact that there's no known natural cause. Because if atheism were true, there has to be a natural explanation for what caused the universe. And scientists and philosophers recognize there has to be a cause that would be enough to bring about about matter in the universe. In other words, they understand that the law of causality demands an explanation, a cause for the universe, and yet no natural cause is known. But again, guess what? We're not in this quandary. You know, creationists believe there's something beyond nature, something supernatural. And again, in the very first verse of the Bible, we're told that God is the ultimate cause of the universe. The creation model has a cause in keeping with science. The evolutionary model doesn't have a cause. So which view is the scientific choice? Hebrews 3:4, every house is built by someone. He who built all things is God. Every house is built by someone. In other words, everything has a cause. Every effect has a cause, people. The ultimate cause of all things, every material entity in existence, according to the Bible, that's God. But wait a minute. Wait a minute. Natural question that comes from this study, you know, it's a sincere question. What caused God? If everything has a cause, why doesn't God have a cause? Well, first of all, the statement everything has a cause isn't really what the law of causality even says, right? That's the first problem with that. Every material effect must have an adequate cause, right? Remember, the laws of science are based on observing nature, right? Not supernature. You can't say that it applies to something we haven't observed. God's not material. He's not physical. John 4:24, he's spirit. But secondly, let's go ahead and think through the logic of this. If there were ever a time in history when nothing existed, then logically, hopefully, we would say nothing would still exist. So even if there was even no God, nothing would still exist because things don't create themselves. That's what the evidence says. Now, something does exist, right? We know that. The universe exists. We at least know that. So by implication, something had to exist forever because you can't get to a time when there was nothing. Okay, but we know that something that had to exist forever can't be physical because the second law of thermodynamics says that's not possible. You can't do that. So that means we've now shown logically there has to be something that's existed forever that's not physical. That's what logic points us to. According to the Bible, that's God. So again, we don't have a problem with science or reason on this. The evolutionary model is in contradiction with science and reason. It requires the baseless assumption that there is no cause, which amounts to superstition and witchcraft. Revisiting our origin model comparison chart as we wrap it up here. Remember, if even only one of these fundamental planks of these two origin models is shown to be false, the entire model collapses. We've seen that according to the laws of thermodynamics, the universe could not have created itself and it couldn't have existed forever. The law of causality adds even more evidence that the universe couldn't have caused itself. It also indicates that life couldn't have created itself because life requires a cause too. According to the law of causality, there has to be an adequate cause for the universe and for life. The evolutionary model can't predict such a cause since it relies on naturalism and atheism. The creation model, however, of course, in perfect harmony with the laws of science on all counts, it argues in keeping with the laws of thermodynamics and the law of causality that matter and life are created by an omnipotent, non-material entity outside of the physical universe and therefore not subject to its laws. Actually wrote the laws. So if one were to stand back at this point and assess which model is best represented by the evidence, which would be the rational choice? God himself wrote the natural laws into existence, which govern or have dominion over the earth. God alone is capable of such a thing. Laws certainly can't write themselves. The atheist can't explain their origin. And the message implied by the laws stand as concrete testaments against atheistic theories to anyone willing to examine the evidence without prejudice. As we close here, got some 7 billion people on the earth today. Christianity boasts about 2.1, about half of those are Catholic, 2.1 billion. Islam, 1.3 billion, quite a bit. Non-religious people over here, right? Atheists, irreligious, and so forth. According to Christianity, according to the Bible, you know, a lot of people always ask the question, apologetics press, what do y'all do, go around apologizing to everybody? Apologetics, right, comes from this Greek word, apologia, which means, anybody know? Defense, right? And so Christians are all supposed to be apologists, defenders. We're supposed to be ready to defend the truth. Now, thankfully, and I appreciate that over the years, the church has seen fit to have an organization like Apologetics Press, because I needed it many times in my schooling, growing up and so forth. You know, there's got to be a way to fund an organization like that, because who has time to do all this research whenever everybody's got other things they're doing that are also important for the kingdom as well? You got to have people that have time to throw in and do this research and make it available so that you guys, the church, has what it needs to defend the truth against not just evolution, but, you know, Islam. And, you know, what about homosexuality and the gay gene and environmentalism and, you know, abortion and capital punishment and the inspiration of the Bible and, you know, all the things that are coming, a lot of the things attacking the church today were not an issue 50 years ago. Things have changed a lot, and there's a lot coming at us. And thankfully, the church, especially this congregation, has really seen the value of Apologetics Press, and we're very much appreciative of it. I want to make sure that you are aware, though, of our existence, any of you especially that are visitors. According to 1 Peter 3:15, we need to be ready to defend the truth. We need to be ready in season and out of season. Here's an eerie warning, Ezekiel 3:18 through 19. When I say to the wicked, you shall surely die, and you give him no warning, nor speak to warn the wicked from his wicked way to save his life, that same wicked man shall die in his iniquity, but his blood I will require at your hand. Yet if you warn the wicked, and he does not turn from his wickedness, nor from his wicked way, he shall die in his iniquity, but you have delivered your soul. You know, our mission is important to God. We need to make sure that we're ready and taking any opportunity we can to defend the truth, study up on the things that we need to study up on so that we're ready at a moment's notice to defend the truth of the Bible. And thank you again for being here on a Friday night. Tomorrow we will continue with a few more of the laws of science and then enter into a discussion on the typical alleged evidences that are given for naturalism. We'll wade through that, dismantle that, and you'll ultimately find that evolution is left without any conclusive evidence to even support it. It's ultimately a blind faith. Thank you for your attention.